Thanks, Chris and Amy. It's a real delight for me to introduce our next speaker. Linda Williams joins us from UC Berkeley. Linda.
You've seen the film By a Woman, For a Woman, now for the film By Men, For Men, But About Women. It's been very exhilarating for me to take part in the enthusiasm of this conference for orphan films. I'd say that all of the things that have been said about sponsored films, educational films, industrial films, issues around canonization, the need to understand more about exhibition and reception, the question of art or the lack thereof, all of this applies to the STAG films that I want to talk, with a few important differences. One is that the STAG films were illegally made and exhibited, and as a result, they haven't been preserved. Nobody studied them. Nobody knows anything about them. They were intentionally anonymous. The other thing is that they were shown to men alone. There may have been some women present, but they were probably there as sort of professionals. Part of this talk is based on an article I recently published in The Moving Image. My topic was not porn films there, nor here. It's really just STAG films in particular, and those held in the Kinsey Archive. If you happen to have read this article, I apologize for repeating myself, but I promise that I won't only repeat myself. Let me just define what I'm talking about. STAG films, which are also called blue movies, are anonymously made, short, undated, silent films, silent way into the late 60s, displaying one or more sex acts. Between about 1905 and the late 1960s, they were seen by men, usually in groups, in parties in the U.S. More than any other form of hardcore pornography, STAG films fascinate me. They offer something of the excitement and potential of all early cinema, and also of a time before cinema became streamlined and efficient. In recording what happens in front of a camera when human beings have sex, sometimes a spark of friction or some kind of spontaneous, unrehearsed movement can be captured. Compared to the perfect bodies and highly professional performances of today's pornography, STAG films can also offer what Tom Waugh has called chance flickers of documentary truth. And these most orphaned of all the orphans should have a place, I think an important place, in our film histories and our film archives. 3 years ago, I was invited to give a talk on women in STAG films at the Kinsey Institute for Research in Sex, Gender, and Reproduction at Indiana University. This talk was part of the 50th anniversary celebration of Alfred Kinsey's controversial 1953 volume, Sexual Behavior in the Human Female. My talk followed a screening of four STAG films from the Kinsey Institute Film Archive. I welcomed the chance to be the introducer of these films because this was the very first time the Kinsey Institute had publicly screened anything of its hardcore STAG collection. I wasn't, however, delighted with what they chose to show. Like the three other films that were shown in the screening that I introduced and lectured on, and the film I'm going to show now, we could start it. The selections were generally just a little too palatable to today's feminist and post-feminist audiences. So I'm going to show you one of them. It's called, sometimes called Getting His Goat, it's sometimes called On the Beach. It's one of the, it's getting kind of dark in here. Oh, thank you. Okay, so it's about a man who steals the clothes of three women who are skinny dipping at the beach. He bargains for sex with them through a knothole in a fence in return for giving them back their clothes. The tables are turned. However, when a goat is substituted for a woman, And later, the women fake pregnancy and extort money from the man who doesn't know that it was a goat that he had sex with rather than a woman. So here's the man. So this is a film that I would imagine a lot of you have seen, if you've seen, you know, any stag films. It's one that is frequently shown in classes. It is anthologized in Alex Dorenzi's A History of the Blue Movie. I know a number it's readily available on videotape. It has had fairly wide distribution, and it's generally, at least all the copies I've ever seen, look this bad. And this is a deterioration of print that is very typical in a subgenre of film that no one has preserved. Since I knew that the selection of this film, along with my presence in the program at the Kinsey Institute, was inevitably to give a certain feminist okay to the routine misogyny of stag films, I decided in my own talk at the Kinsey Institute to resist this tendency and to show some films that did not make audiences feel quite as comfortable, films in which the joke was not necessarily, as this film was, on the man. In doing this, I was also indirectly trying to answer the criticism leveled against me by a couple of film scholars, Peter Lehman and Constance Penley, arguing that I have overlooked the humor of many porn films. Penley argues, for example, that stag films especially are full of humor, and that the narrative, which is often more vignette than fully developed story, is often structured like a joke. Farmer's daughter, traveling salesman, Aggie jokes, etc. I think Penley and Lehman are right to point to the uses of humor in pornography. However, I'm not so sure that we do a service to the modest field of porn studies by characterizing the whole of pornography, or even just the stag film portion of that history, as humorous, even bad joke humor, especially if we are led to believe, along with this assessment, that the joke is often on the man. Like the Kinsey Institute's public screening itself, Penley's argument is based on highly selective examples like this one, in which women viewers today can comfortably laugh and ignores many less comfortable kinds of examples. And here we have the man forking over the money. If getting his goat offers a Rabelaisian body humor, in which women literally and figuratively get the man's goat and humiliate him rather than themselves, extorting money from him to boot, we should not then reassess the whole of stag cinema as subversive folk humor. Rather, we should consider that the women depicted in this particular film exhibit something more than what Penley calls charming mischievousness. In fact, they are surprisingly blasé and calculating. For example, the woman who orchestrates the goat substitution has first collected the man's money, and then, as we're about to see, she will rather efficiently warm up his penis manually through the knothole in the fence. She gives every sign, in other words, of being something like a professional. Tom Waugh has written, quote, The hooker presides over the entire corpus of stag films, inflected by the familiar, don't worry, in fact, you never actually see the goat and the man in the same shot. So it's palatable in that way as well. Tom Waugh writes that the hooker presides over the entire corpus of stag films, inflected by the familiar, hypocritical, class-centric contempt for the working girl. The women in stag films know how to perform for and upon the man as well as for the camera. The men, comparatively, do not. This does not mean, however, that the women therefore have more power. If the female performers were undoubtedly assumed by the audience to be sex workers, which is what Tom Waugh thinks, then this may explain why the women are often so much more naked while the men are comparatively clothed. And this is an example of that. In the context of the stag film, then, the woman is in control in the way the prostitute is in control in order to better serve the John who hires her. The charming mischievousness that we observe in Getting His Goat may thus well come from the fact that these particular women did not have to work in the usual way. In fact, the goat does it for them. Whatever female agency we witness in stag films is very often circumscribed by the fact that in them the woman is selling herself in a way that the men are not, and there is always a greater contempt for the seller than there is for the buyer. This is true even in films that do not directly show, as this film actually does, an exchange of money. Thus, in another popular stag film for contemporary screening, and this one is shown at the Museum of Sex in New York, at least the last time I saw, The Casting Couch from 1920s, the actress who wants a role but refuses the advances of the casting director reads in a book How to Become a Star, that she should comply with the casting director. She does, and the film's final title puns, "The only way to become a star is to get under a good director and work your way up." Sex, like money, is clearly a medium of exchange. Penley argues that this film mocks the professional classes, and while this is certainly the case, and she would argue that this one does too, the logic of the dirty joke is often quite punitive to the woman. All right, so that's On the Beach or Getting His Goat. Many of the films in the Stag Film Archive are of extreme interest for what they tell us about sex workers, prostitution, or to use a more loaded term, but one that has been used, white slavery. I introduce this term because it is the one used by Candy Barr, the star of another frequently shown stag film, something of a classic, Smart Aleck of the 1950s. In this popular stag film, the then 16-year-old star has sex with a man in a hotel room after she's picked up at the motel pool. When she resists performing fellatio, she picks up the phone and calls a friend who is willing. She then joins the three-way. Penley writes that this action illustrates female agency. While I suppose I could be pleased that Smart Aleck stopped short of showing Candy Barr being forced to perform fellatio, I would emphasize that what we actually see in that film is a rather prolonged tussle in which the man repeatedly tries to hold her mouth over his penis and she wriggles out. It is the man who then gets up in disgust, at which point Candy phones her friend. Once again, the agency demonstrated is circumscribed by the situation of prostitution. Indeed, the negotiation over fellatio shown in the motel room seems very much to be over what Barr will and will not do for money. And the friend she calls in to perform fellatio would certainly seem to be yet another working girl. There's no way to tell whether the narrative of this particular film depicts what actually happened to Candy Barr in the motel room. That is, whether as a sexual performer in a stag film, she was asked to perform an act she found distasteful and resisted, or whether the tension over fellatio was part of the script. It is interesting, however, to listen to what Barr says in her own description of this period of her life. And I'm getting this out of an interview that was shown in a documentary called The Story of X. As the first porn star whose porn name was known to the public, Barr's description of her situation at the time she made the film is of interest for its revelation of the gray area between working girl and prostitute. So listen to the way she puts it. "I ended up eventually from being a working girl in a restaurant as a waitress into a white slavery involvement that involved itself over a period of time into motel people, and this is how it all started. If I had not been under duress, I certainly would not have gone and willingly done it. I had other things to do in my life than go out in a motel room and let people take pictures of me." Now, I'm not absolutely sure what the "it" in "this is how it all started" refers, whether it's her unprecedented fame as a porn star or her involvement in prostitution. But I think we can see, even in this sort of tortured syntax, that Barr is grappling with the fact that to be a low-class working girl in a restaurant slides rather easily into the other form of working girl in a motel room. Barr is, of course, also claiming that she performed these acts under duress and that the phrase white slavery involvement raises all sorts of flags, managing to be both sensational and sort of vague. The term white slavery first became current in the U.S. in the Progressive Era to describe the buying and selling of young girls into prostitution. As is well known today, the burgeoning social, scientific, and reformist discourses defining it were deeply racist. They were racist both in the sense of worrying only about the sexual slavery of white women, never that of women of color, and in the frequent allegations that the sexual traffic of white women was an organized conspiracy run by Jews and foreigners. They were also dubious as examples of overt coercion. It is likely that social factors such as poverty, low wages, and other deprivations were more responsible than evil foreigners coercing young girls to sell themselves. White slavery was already an anachronistic term by the time Candy Barr used it in her this 1998 documentary that I'm quoting. Yet Barr does not go on to claim, as her more famous early 70s successor Linda Lovelace would do, that she was damaged by her involvement in pornography. Indeed, she's quick to clarify that what bothers her today is not the outrage to her innocence or the trauma of the event, but something else entirely. And I quote, "I know one thing, that was a tacky guy they got for me, and that's an insult." The interview then concludes with Barr's remarkably benign observation about pornography. Let's face it, it's here, it's slapping us in the face, let's make it respectable. It would seem, despite the inflammatory reference to white slavery invoked as a way to suggest that forces beyond her control led her at the age of 16 to a career in prostitution and stag films, that Barr's fundamental identification is as a working girl who seeks respect as such. She does not go on to blame pornography or the traffic in women as the source of her ruin. That would be to play into the logic of the police and the Johns who condemn the sellers, not the buyers, of female goods. Rather, she goes on to wish for better, more respectable working conditions and status. The fact that the narrative of the film then shows her negotiating for one aspect of these conditions in her refusal to perform fellatio is thus quite apt. In this interview, Barr's intonation as she gropes for the word respectable is both tentative and poignant. In an earlier era, when the kind of illicit underground stag films in which she performed were made, when pornography was precisely not slapping anyone in the face, but the men at the stag parties, a plea for respect would have been out of the question. Women in porn were whores, whether they played them as characters or not. Tom Waugh has suggested that the stag corpus may well be the best visual ethnography of sex workers in America during this period. The notion is worth taking seriously. The value of a term like sex worker is in its emphasis on the field of sexuality as a place where women, and of course some men, do indeed work. I would not want to assume that every film depicts the relations between a prostitute and a John, and probably some of the men in the films were paid for their work as well. However, the consequences of the men's actions were never as stigmatizing to them as the actions of women performers. Their performances did not make them sluts, but studs. Nor is the work performed in stag films by men or women simply the work of prostitution, since the requirement of this work is not only to please the customer, but to please the viewer. Sex worker is a useful term because it allows us to focus on the work of giving pleasure in sex. It applies to all persons who sell sex, whether strippers, lap dancers, male, female, or transgendered prostitutes, phone sex providers, or porn performers, without distinction of class. It connotes a freely chosen profession. It was precisely the sort of term Candy Barr might have been looking for, a term that would accomplish the greater respectability she seeks. The exact opposite of white slavery, with its lurid connotations of racialized exploitation and spoiled innocence, sex worker has served as an effective counter to the notion that women who perform sex for money are enslaved and then hopelessly fallen. Nevertheless, the word is also anachronistic for the period in which stag films were dominant. It has a euphemistic tinge of political correctness that does not quite fit the actual attitudes towards the women who performed sex for hire from the teens through the late 1960s and who now repeat those sex acts in the stag film archives. We need a more historically nuanced way of reading female agency in stag films, something that can be located between white slavery, an old-fashioned term, and the ethnography of sex workers, something that can also include the different situation of American women of color in stag films, something that can avoid the melodramatic scenarios of extreme victimization while acknowledging the gray areas between lurid coercion and honest work. In order to qualify just what sort of agency we can imagine for the various women of stag films, I want to mention two more films, one that I can show and one that I can't. The one that I can show you, I'll just start screening right now. The one that I can't show you, I want to talk about for a bit. So you now have two things to do. You have to watch this film, which I will talk about in a minute. Let me just say that it has no title. I have called it DK, after the person who made them. And I call this one DK Blonde in Purple Pants. It's from around 1969. So just watch this for a while. The one that I can't show you is called KKK Night Riders. It looks to be from about the 30s, though it's hard to tell given the poor quality of the print and the fact that the only real clothes that are worn are a Klansman robe and hood. It portrays a corpulent white Klansman in full regalia, including hood, who invades the cabin of a black woman and forces her to have sex at night point. I saw this film at the Kinsey Institute when I last visited at the time of giving my talk, but unlike the films that were shown in the public screening, in which the Institute very freely lent me for purposes of preparing my talk, this film, KKK Night Riders, has never been publicly screened. The Kinsey Institute, which is located in Indiana, a place that is a little sensitive about Klan history, has not let a copy off the premises. I tried to borrow it to show it in a class and in order to write about it, and Susan Courtney tried to borrow it for the occasion of this conference. And the answer that we were given when we tried to get it was, "The library and special collections of the Kinsey Institute make up a private research collection intended for scholars' use. And while the symposium," that is this symposium, "is scholarly in nature, we do not feel the requested film is an appropriate representation of our film collection." And my question is, you know, what is an appropriate representation? As in all stag films depicting rape, the woman in KKK Night Riders is portrayed as succumbing to the pleasures of coerced sex. After a crudely handwritten title, we see a hand knock on a door, a man in Klan robes enters holding a knife aloft. Another hand also holds aloft a short sword. A black woman reading a newspaper in bed reacts to his presence. The man's hand pulls down the sheet covering her to reveal her naked and also plump body. A title card reads, "Oh Lordy, don't hurt me, I'll give you my all," after which the knife is held to her belly. Then she says, "Here I am, Mr. Klansman, I'm all yours." When they begin to have sex, another card speaks the misogynist and racist ethic of the film, "All night riders must have their fun." The fun portrayed is about 10 minutes of sex in a wide variety of positions. At one point, the Klansman says, "You're sure hot. I'll remove my white mask," though his face still remains obscured in what appears to be a stocking and cap underneath his hood and mask. At one point, the woman asks in another intertitle, "Does you all feel good now, Mr. Klansman?" At another point during an interlude, their portly black and white bodies form a surprising picture of intimacy, as if the Klansman's assault had actually formed the kind of intimate interracial couple that the Klan itself abhorred. What interests me in KKK Night Riders are its similarities and differences to the coercive scenarios of stag films that involve class, not racial, differences. The working girls in Getting His Goat are coerced by a dreamer in glasses who looks to be a college kid. The class differences between them are part of the reason for our contemporary feminist satisfaction at the revenge of the girls. The Klansman, who so carefully guards his face from view, is also of a different class from the woman whose cabin he invades, as indicated by actually different speech patterns in the intertitles. But this man is of a different race as well, and he is cloaked in the very costume of white supremacy. His coercion of the black woman evokes a long history of racial and sexual servitude in which the ethic of honest work for pay does not exist. One reason I think that KKK Night Riders is an important historical document of the limits of female agency in stag film is that it reminds us of a history of actual sexual slavery that the term sex worker cannot encompass. Here is a situation that grows so directly out of slavery, though not the white slavery of Candy Bar's formulation, that it might be wishful thinking to consider the woman who performs in this film as a sex worker. The term is too progressive. It says too little about the historically determined coercive context of black female and white male sexual interactions depicted under the sign of white supremacy designed to reassert the race and gender-based prerogatives of white men. This woman has historically less agency than her white sister performers and less chance of asserting herself as a worker. Only if one buys into white supremacist beliefs can we think that the joke in KKK Night Riders is on the man. It would only be on him if we believe that he degrades himself by having sex with the black woman, just as the dreamer in Getting His Goat degrades himself, without quite knowing it, when he has sex with a goat. Although it would be comforting from where we sit today to read this Klansman without a horse, whose only ride is on the black woman he rapes, as giving the lie to the myth of the Klan as the rescuers of white womanhood, I fear that for the white men who saw it in its circulation at stag parties and fraternal organizations during the Depression, that the only possible way to see the film is as a joke on its Night Rider would be to have to buy into the white supremacism that views sex with a black woman as degrading. And this brings me to the film that you've been watching, which is owned by a collector who explicitly chose not to donate his collection to the Kinsey Institute because he believed the Kinsey would neither care for his collection nor make it available for teachers to use. There are about 60 films like this, all made by one man whose initials are DK, and so I call it DK, Blonde with Purple Pants. Though made in the late 60s and early 70s, and thus representing the end of the stag era, it resembles other stag films in its length, silence, rather discontinuous narrative. It is unique, however, in the somewhat disconcerting proximity of the woman. I don't know if we should call her a sex worker, a whore, or a proto-porn star. In this post-sexual revolution era, we surely cannot see her as sold into white slavery. Even more than other stag films, this one elides the view of the body of the man, showing only a hand and a penis. When I first saw one of these DK films, as I call them, it took me quite a while to realize that the slightly uncanny intimacy is achieved by the fact that this is not a moving image representation of a scene of sex. This is a moving image representation from within a scene of sex. It is the cameraman's hand and penis that we see, and what we see of him is more or less what he sees of himself. What difference this makes in understanding this late form of stag film, I haven't quite figured out. But this film, as well as KKK Night Riders, as well as Getting His Goat, as well as countless other films that have not been seen or studied, needs to be made available for scholars to characterize the full variety of stag films. Any screening of stag films offers a public display of a kind of film that had once only been for private consumption by prurient men. These films were not acquired by the Kinsey Institute to preserve film history, but as a record of sexual practices of all its films. All of its films, the ones that were originally collected at the Kinsey Institute, were illicitly made and distributed. No one properly owns their copyright. It's something of a miracle, and a tribute to Alfred Kinsey's voracious, non-judgmental interest in everything having to do with sex, that this archive exists at all. I do not claim to know how an archive of hardcore films should present its contents to scholars and to the public, but I do believe that any archive, even a sex film archive, exists in order to be preserved and for its contents to be made available to those interested in its materials. In my work on pornography, it has become increasingly clear to me that sexual representations that were once considered obscene, in the quite literal sense of being hidden away from public view, have increasingly come on scene in all sorts of ways, and stag films are no exception. The real issue is how to best present the heritage of stag films without either overly nostalgicizing or totally defanging their content. Stag film compilations, such as the recent French compilation, which is circulating under the title, in English, The Good Old Naughty Days, makes the mistake of offering tinkling piano accompaniment as if they were the equivalent of Harold Lloyd or Charlie Chaplin comedies. Though I am glad they exist, they run the risk of a bogus nostalgia associated with mainstream silent films. Neither the Kinsey program, which was chosen for its humor and relative female control, thank you, nor the Good Old Naughty Days represent the archives from which they are chosen. I think all I really need to say is that I planned with the archivist who invited me to the Kinsey Institute to put together a DVD compilation of, it was something like, you know, more treasures from the from the Kinsey archive. That was actually the model, but the Indiana University lawyers threw up obstacles. They wanted Kino, which was going to do it, to accept all liability for the project, and they were fearful that if they did not, the university would be sued. So I'm personally not an archivist. I have ended up with an archive of the films you've just been seeing and quite a few others, because rather than give them to Kinsey, they've given them to me. My university isn't really prepared for this. I don't know what to do. And I sort of throw it out to you. I think we should make, somebody should make, the compilation DVD. It seems to me that this is every bit as important as Dutch educational films. It is the sexual history of many of us. Okay, fine. I'm just going to leave it at that. Thank you very much.
We have minutes for a few comments, questions for our speakers here. Is there a mic? We can get the mics down. Go ahead. Can you just use your full voice?
Compelled to perform gender? Is that something like that? And also, is the director then a sex worker as well? Or is it?
Yes, well, I think the DK, I suppose, does become a sex worker, but the fact that he holds the camera and, you know, sort of is contracting presumably with the women, makes, you know, puts him in a slightly different category than most women. Performing gender? Well, I suppose of course they're performing gender.
I would like to put your question directly to Christopher and Amy. What would you advise the Kinsey Institute to do to revise or not revise its current policy? This is your future. You have to, you literally, these are the types of issues you're going to have to deal with.
Let me just say that the librarian with whom I was working to do this DVD was fired. I don't think she was fired because she was planning to do this, but the Kinsey Institute is not, it just basically has nobody overseeing its archive now.
Maybe Chris has a more concrete answer than I do, but I mean, I think it's obvious that we advocate access to all materials, and obviously this is a really touchy subject to a lot of people, but access is really important, so obviously 100% access to whoever is interested.
And I would say that it even grows increasingly important, as we mentioned in our presentation, as there grow increasing limitations on defining marriage, sexuality, gender roles, and not to say that archivists need to become extremely political to try to go against, like administration, like governmental administration, but archivists need to be people that share knowledge and not hide it, because that's our job.
I think Rick has the mic, and then we can.
Thanks, Amy and Chris. That was great, and I obviously totally buy that idea of civic engagement. That these issues are, you know, to a great extent, going to be articulating outside the walls of archives. I thought you put your finger on a really interesting sort of contradiction with regard to access. So you called attention to sort of sex positive, feminist informed, erotic, pornographic sex ed filmmaking, especially sex ed filmmaking. So there's the, you know, there was the Serious Business Company library, mostly feminist films, many of which were very explicit. There's the films that Linda and I were talking about the other night, the Multimedia Resource Center films made out of San Francisco, films by people like Connie Beeson, Laird Sutton, and so on. Huge tradition of incredibly sex positive, you know, very kind of technique oriented films. And the reason, so it's much easier to put your hands on films that are corporate productions because they go out of copyright. There's millions of or hundreds of thousands of prints out there. And the contradiction I think you broach is some of the more interesting and radical films potentially are made by individuals. And so the question of orphan works by individuals and artists' rights and ripping off people who, you know, may still have active copyrights is a question that we don't really have a very good answer for in the archival field. I mean, a lot of that work's actually been preserved, but it's pretty inaccessible largely for rights reasons. And we've got to come up with a strategy for access to work by individuals that's not so ancient.
Most definitely.
Can you pass the mic back to Jill?
I agree with Rick. There was enormous amount of material made in the 70s when women finally got hold of cameras and funding to make women-centered films. But I don't think it's so hard to put together an anthology of that work. I mean, Linda Pfefferman, I haven't seen her in a number of years, but she's still here. And so are three quarters of the people who were doing that work. So get it now, you know, and document it. This should not be a major piece of archaeology to find these films, probably get the rights to anthologize them and interview the filmmakers. But it was a little weird hearing you guys talk because I'm of that generation and suddenly felt mummified, you know, like we were off the map and now you guys have to go dig up these films. You know, like, not so. And two, they were part of a feminist project. It would be terrible to see them as outside of or separated from us as only about sexual sex and gender. You know, they were part of a whole taking up of the camera and the film to put ourselves back into the universe in some way. So don't let them separate out as just other newer, fresher sex films. You know, like they really have a history. And a
no, and that's why we advocate that they be shared by all forms of scholarship and research, and that they're included in not only in the history of motion picture film, but in the history of women's rights and feminism and yeah.
Yeah. Can I just briefly ask Judith a question? Do you know how weird it was to watch that film, Linda? Sorry, and try and listen to what you were saying. I mean, have you done that before, or
no.
Is that an idea about performing paper? You know, that was
I know, that was so weird.
You know,
but I could have showed a lot more. I tried to.
Can we pass the mic down to Paula? She says, down near the front here.
Sort of where my question is coming from, actually. Linda, I'd like you to sort of speak about the fact that, or reflect upon the sort of distinct nature of these films, which is that they work continuously. They're still working on us in a way that a lot of these other films that we've been watching over the past few days simply don't function anymore. You know, the film that we watched is successful. It continues to work. It does its job. And if it came out as an anthology, it would do very well. you know, so I wonder if you could just speak about, reflect upon. It's
yeah.
not only about Stag films, but in comparison to all of the other films that we've been watching where we're mining the secondary significations of the film to some extent, these are films that still retain their primary utilitarian function in some way.
I don't know that all do. I mean, did you find that getting his goat did? I mean, my sense is that there's a kind of a distance there, and the, you know, I've had the experience of trying to teach the history of pornography to undergraduates as well as graduate students, and I find that if I make the mistake of showing the Stag films early, I don't really present the students with what they're facing in the class, because in fact they can distance themselves from that so successfully. It's their grandparents or their great grandparents, and that's just a sexuality that isn't theirs somehow. Whereas I've learned that it's important to show some of the more contemporary work or work like this that does do its work in order to make them understand that you know this is what we do have to engage with. I think it's, you know, we can't forget that. But I think that's precisely the reason it's not going to be made into an anthology. I mean, who's going to fund it? Who's going to, what archive is going to proudly parade its work? I mean, obviously the Kinsey isn't going to. But they don't have access to the works.
Chris, you want to have the last? Sorry, I see a hand here.
There's a question over
Chris?
There.
Oh, sorry, there's already. Yeah, go ahead. Who's got the mic?
Linda, you mentioned the Museum of Sex, which is a relatively new institution. I was wondering if you've been there as a researcher and if you could say anything about how they're dealing with collections along the same lines as Kinsey on a new model.
You know, I don't know. I know that I don't think they're actually much of an archive. I could be wrong. It's probably a relatively small archive. It is what it says it is, a museum of sex. And so, McKinsey has been the archive. There, I know some private collectors and some private, the Institute for the Study, the Advanced Study of Sexuality. But the Stag history is in the Kinsey. As far as I know, it's nowhere as thoroughly. It's not thoroughly anywhere else.
I think we should make or have no illusions about the fact that the Kinsey is the only place that has such films, that every single major archive, whether you know Eastman House or Museum of Modern Art or Library of Congress or any other, they all have porn films, Stag films, porn films, etc. Now, may not collect them in quite the systematic way that the Kinsey did, but they all do. And I think that is an issue for all the archivists in these institutions. And that
when I ask them,
they say they don't. Of course they do. Of course they do. And in fact, they do. And at Eastman House, for example, we would have the print of Deep Throat, one of the classics, of course, came into the collections when there was a trial in Rochester involving that film in 1970 or 71. And it is cataloged under the title of She Knew What She Wanted at Eastman House, in case you are looking for it.
Thank you.
Okay. We knew this panel would get you going, and sure enough, it did. I think we're quite behind, but we also had a vision that the big stakes issues here of access and ethics and controversial materials will continue into the next panel. So why don't we have a short break, and we'll come back, and the conversation can continue in other forms. Thank you so much to the panelists. Behind schedule, but